A big thanks to this season's sponsor, Picaluna Beautiful Funerals, who are reinventing how we say goodbye to the people we love.
Because let's be real, being prepared for a death can feel like a really daunting task, but it's so important to understand your options. And Picaluna puts your choice front and center through more personalized, compassionate, and affordable funerals.
So start having the conversation today.
Listening to Good Morning, the podcast talking all things grief with honesty and humour. Welcome back to the Good Morning podcast.
We hope you are all doing okay. And if you are new here, welcome. We are your hosts, Sal and Im. And Sal, tell us, how are you before we get stuck into today's episode?
I'm doing well. I have made a really big decision, actually, to go home. For the first time since mum died. I mean, home is now Australia. So back to the UK, my original home. So that's been a long time coming. In a couple of months, I'm going to be heading over there. And it's wild to think that it's actually the first time that I would have been back since she died. Like the last time I was there, I was dealing with her death and her funeral. And I flew back here to Australia a couple of days after her funeral. So it's been a bit of a mixed bag of emotions. Like I'm very prepared for it to be maybe triggering, but then maybe I've done a lot of work, so maybe it won't be. I don't know.
I can imagine how you're feeling right now, because I was kind of in that place and it was very different because your mum died when you were at opposite ends of the world. But even just going back to the suburb where my mum lived after she died, it was like this huge thing. You were with me. You know how hard it was. So I can imagine like getting on a plane and going all the way back there, you might be dreading it. But yeah, it's hard to know how you'll feel unless you're there though, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I've got a lot of support around me. I'm excited to see everyone. But I think it's going to be weird because I'm going to be around family and people who knew her. So we'll be talking about her a lot. And whereas I guess here, because my life is a little bit removed from it, because not everyone apart from like aunt and a few friends knew her. So she doesn't come up in conversation a lot unless people are asking me questions about her. So there's not that kind of people asking like, or sharing memories and stuff like that. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting one, but I am excited to go back as well and do a little bit of Europe too, which would be good.
Bit of Europe. We're going to try and do a sneaky night in Paris. I mean, that sounds really dodgy. We're going to try and do a night or two in Paris together. We're going to make this happen. So yeah. Hopefully, because I'm going to be over there at the same time.
Yeah, we're going to be both going to be in the UK at the same time. So to get griefy in Paris. So that's me. That's been a lot of my life over the last week, just trying to, prep for that and get everything sorted and book flights and all that jazz. How are you, Im?
Have you already packed your passport?
That'll be next week. So Im always takes a piss out of me because I am like, I don't know if it's an anxiety thing, but like I'm definitely one of those people that packs like a week before a trip and then repacks and then packs again and like double checks. I mean, it might be an ADHD thing as well, like the over organization, but like I have to get to the airport as well, like 5 hours early. Otherwise I feel so full of anxiety. Whereas Im, you're a bit more like last minute Larry, aren't you?
I'm a last minute packer for sure.
Like when you organized the itinerary when we went to Melbourne that time and it was like all very like last, like everything was cutting it fine. I was like, deep breaths.
Yeah, you're like, we don't have 5 hours for a domestic flight in. Where, how have you not factored that in? I'm like, Sal, you just got to get there half an hour before, mate. We'll be fine.
I think we balance each other out. But how are you going? Last week was our first episode of the season and we talked about your story and it was a really big thing for you to do. So how are you going?
I am okay. It was a really big thing to do. I just want to say thank you so much to everyone who has reached out with your kind words. It means so much. I've read every single response. I'm doing okay. It was obviously hard to do and put out there, but it was important. And yeah, I just really want it to help anyone who may be going through something similar, just to know that they're not alone and these things happen. And yeah, I'm feeling okay.
good. And I'm absolutely sure it will help other people out there. And I'm glad that you're okay. I know you had, a few griefy days surrounding it, which is absolutely understandable, isn't it? But it's good to see you here now and doing all right. And we, talking of grief, which is obviously the topic of this podcast, we have got a bit of a grief kingpin in today's episode, haven't we?
Yes, we have. So many of you loved our episode with Dr. Lisa Shulman about grief brain. And so today we're talking to another renowned neurologist and expert on the grieving brain, Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. So some of you may be familiar with her already. She is author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss. So Mary Frances is the authority on the neurology of grief. And in this conversation, she shares her scientific research and her practical knowledge about how brains respond to loss. And it is fascinating, isn't it, Sal?
It's so fascinating, and it's so complimentary, I think, to the conversation that we had with Dr. Lisa Shulman, which popped off, didn't it? So many people love that episode. So I think you guys are going to find this fascinating and hopefully really helpful, because the grief brain is real, isn't it?
Oh, it very much is.
It really is.
It's one of the most common symptoms of grief that our community experiences. We hear time and time again. We've had our own grief brain moment. Sal, care to fill us in on yours, your finest grief brain story?
I think my finest grief brain story is washing my dogs with a biscuit, thinking that it was dog shampoo, and really scrubbing, and I was really confused as to why I was not getting any lather on this soap, and poor old Albert was just getting scrubbed with a dog biscuit. So I think that was definitely one of my finest. What about you, Im?
Mine would have to be the bok choy gate, where I did an online shop and I was cooking, I don't know, some sort of stir fry. And the online shop got delivered at the door, and there were at least 50 bunches of bok choy in all these bags, separate bags just full of bok choy. I got into a little bit of trouble for that one.
So what did you do with them? Did you give them out, or did you use them? Or was it bok choy for the next 2 weeks?
No. I handed them out to my neighbours. So I was like, do you guys need any bok choy? So a lot of people actually took them, which was amazing. So they didn't go to waste, which was good. But never again.
Good.
I always triple check.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever use bok choy. You've inspired me. Maybe I will. Anyway, digression. Mary Frances, she is the authority on the grieving brain, and I really loved her insights around what happens to our brain after we experience loss, and her analogy as to why it's a little bit like Google Maps that need resyncing. We're not going to spoil it, so keep on listening, but she's got some fascinating analogies, and I think it can actually apply to anyone coping with a difficult time, can't it? The way that our brain responds to emotional stress after a death, and also after lots of other difficult life experiences. I know both of us have experienced other things in our life where we've felt the fog. So hopefully this will be an interesting combo for anyone, whether you're grieving or not. One more thing, KM.
One more thing. We just want to thank you guys as well for everyone who has left us a beautiful book review. You guys, we just want to read one of the reviews out for you. In case you haven't read our book yet, this can give you a little bit of flavor of what to expect. So we had a beautiful review come in from DLN in Canada, and they said, "This book is extraordinary. Sal and Im have taken their own experience with maternal grief and loss, which could have been narrowly focused, and used it to create relatable and accessible resource for people dealing with grief of all kinds. Their writing style makes you feel like you're having a chat over a drink with people who really get it. A huge strength of the book is the inclusion of not just of grievers' stories, which helps the reader feel seen, but the connected section, What's Helped, which gives practical and tested advice for strategies to cope when things feel really dark or tough. I'm so grateful to Sal and Im for writing this book, and recommend it to everyone who finds themselves in the sticky and unimaginable world of grieving." Thank you so much. What a lovely review.
What an amazing review.
So, guys, don't forget.
Thanks, DLN.
Yeah. If you've read our book on a platform, please go on to wherever you bought it from and leave us a review. It helps our book. And also, don't forget to hit subscribe so you get every new episode of the pod as soon as they go live. And if Good Morning has helped you and you have a spare minute, it would mean so much if you could leave us a rating or a short review, as it helps the pod get seen by others who may be needing some extra griefy support.
Just a few requests there, guys, but honestly, it would be amazing as it really does help other people who might need some grief support. And just a very quick one, you can buy signed copies of our book via our website now, and also stay tuned for a very exciting membership that is launching soon. You can find out more and sign up to the waitlist with the link in the show notes. Right, let's get on to it.
Mary Frances, it is so great to have you with us today. Grief and the brain is definitely one of the most requested topics from our audience. So to start, we'd just love to know how you came into the field of neuroscience and researching the grieving brain.
Well, there's probably a professional answer and a personal answer to that. You know, I think the professional answer is really that I am fascinated by the brain. I mean, it really is the most remarkable organ in the universe, I think. The question of sort of how does it encode our loved ones, right? It knows who our loved ones are and motivates us to go seek them out. That just pure curiosity sort of led me down the road of studying neuroimaging. And the more personal answer around studying grief is that my own mother was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 13 years old, and she was only supposed to live through the year. It was stage 4 breast cancer, and she actually, she outpaced all the odds. She lived another 13 years, which was just such a remarkable, reprieve from the universe, I like to say, for my sister and I. But what it meant was that, you know, we certainly got to know what grief was like, and it meant that I felt comfortable then when I was training as a clinical psychologist. Yeah, I felt comfortable talking with people about their grief and, you know, seeing them cry and really listening to what they were saying, not assuming what they were experiencing, but really trying to listen and then match that sort of experience they were telling me about with these brain images that I was seeing when they agreed to participate in my studies.
And we don't listen very well unless we've been through it ourselves. And that's what we're definitely finding since we've, you know, come into grief as well. But that is a lot of anticipatory grief that you experience from such a young age. What was that experience like for you?
Well, it's interesting. Of course, I look back now with decades of lens, so to speak. So I think, you know, at the time, that just felt like what being 13 was like. I knew that was not the experiences of my friends, but certainly I didn't have a lot of context for it. I think that now, looking back, I recognize that, you know, I think grief at that age is really challenging in the sense that our bodies and our minds are motivating us to go out and explore the world. That's sort of the developmental task where we're meant to be on. And when there's terminal illness and when there's death, there's this sort of continuous off-ramp back to home, back to the family, back to the sort of withdrawal of those feelings of grief. And so those are very much in conflict then. And that certainly described a lot of my experience during that time. But I will say that, my father died about 8 years ago now, and that experience was entirely different going through his final stages because I was an adult and because I'd been through the death of a parent once, you know? And so I think each experience is so unique based on the relationship you have, but also who you are at the time and the experiences you've had with death and loss.
It's so true. And we've had quite a few guests on the podcast previously who've experienced death later in life and then when they were younger, or have experienced anticipatory grief and sudden loss. And you're so right, it does, it really is individual based on the time and the place and who we are. And something you talk about in your book is that grief can be, it's like living in two worlds.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because yeah. I think a lot of our listeners will find it really interesting.
Well, you know, if you think about it, whenever we are, you know, moving through the world, we have this internal representation of what the world is like. Mm-hmm. So we have sort of a Google Maps, so to speak, of the world. And for the most part, that's very efficient for us, isn't it? It's not like every time you walk through your house, you have to think, oh, there's a couch, I should walk around that, right? That's just what you do because your internal map, you know, already accounts for it. Well, the challenge really with grieving is that when we lose a loved one, that internal map of the world doesn't update right away. And so we continue to expect our loved one. We expect to walk into a room and they will be there. Or we expect, you know, the plants to get watered because they're in the world. And so when the plants start dying, suddenly we're confronted with the fact that our internal understanding of the world does not map on to the actual world. And so there's this huge learning curve at so many different levels of, wait a minute, my understanding of the world is totally wrong now. And how do I understand what the world is really like? And God forbid, how do I actually manage to be in that world? I think it's that disconnect that's incredibly difficult for people, and the amount of time and effort and sort of pain that updating our understanding of the world requires.
It's so interesting. It makes so much sense, but we often don't think of it that way at all, do we? Like Sal and I, our mums died suddenly. So there was a lot of that trying to, you know, how are we supposed to come to terms with this new world that we had no preparation for? Like it was a minefield.
Yeah. And it did feel like it was so hard to comprehend.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing that comprehension piece is the maps kind of are out of sync, right? And
yeah.
And how long, like, I mean, how long is a piece of string, right? I guess it's individual to the person, how long it takes to kind of configure those two maps. But I really like that analogy because it just feels like, you know, it's happened, you know, they're dead, but then also like you think that you see them, or, you know, you still think they're going to walk in the door or call you or send you a text, and it's like you sort of come to and you're like, oh no, hang on a minute. They're gone. And it can be the most confusing feeling, can't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, a lot of people, I think, feel like they're losing their mind, which they're not actually, but temporarily, it certainly does feel that way. I think it can be really helpful with a podcast like yours to hear other people say, this has been my experience as well. And as you said, that it's not permanent, right? So I think part of thinking about you know, I like to think of grieving as a form of learning, right? And that, I think, makes it a little more approachable. But that learning, like I was saying, happens at lots of different levels. So if you think that, you know, for a while, especially with a sudden loss, that your loved one is sort of, I call it the gone but also everlasting hypothesis, that you have these two streams of information that cannot both possibly be true, and yet you believe both of them. And so you do things like, you know, texting your mom and then realizing, wait, what am I doing? I can't do that. And so there's everything from sort of at the level of just habits like that. You see that birthday card and you think, oh, this will be perfect for mom this year. And then you realize she's not going to have another birthday. So there's sort of learning at that level. But there's another kind of learning as well, I think, which is related, which is that a piece of who we are is also bound up with that other person. So the question of sort of, what does it mean to be a daughter if my mom is gone? What does it mean to be a good daughter if my mom is gone? And how will it look to have, you know, children without a grandmother? Like, what does that even mean? And so I think there's also a lot of coming to understand yourself differently and how you function in the world, given that this person is not there by your side every day.
That makes so much sense. And do you think there's an element to it? Because grief is often pathologized in Western society, or society, and it's particularly true here in Australia, don't want to acknowledge grief, so they don't talk about it. So because there's that silence, or that people shy away from the topic, does that disrupt the map as well? Is there an element that impacts it too?
This is such a good question. I think that Western science doesn't do a very good job of studying more than the individual. So it makes sense that I might look into one person's brain, right, to think about how grief is being experienced. But of course, these are stories we all make up together about what it means to have lost this person. And so you think about, I mean, the holidays is a perfect example, right, where you're all going to get together. You all know that this person is not going to be with you, and that means something different for each person, but that as a family, or as a group of friends, or as a neighborhood or a workplace, you are also together creating the story of what it means. And I don't mean story in a false sort of way. You're sort of chronicling what it means that this person is gone. And does that mean, you know, that the center of the family has fallen away and people aren't going to spend time together? Or does it mean that because she is gone, that means that, you know, rallying the troops and making sure everyone makes more of an effort where she might have, people need to step up and do the things that make holiday for you. So those sorts of ways that we understand the world are also jointly decided upon and experienced. And and so I think that's a piece of it that we study much less.
I've got a $1 million question for you. I know that there is absolutely no timeline to grief, but through the work that you've done, have you seen, is there sort of an average time for an uncomplicated death that it takes for somebody, you know, for this mapping to take place, for them to come to terms with this new world in their brain neurologically?
The way I like to think about this, because I think you're right, I don't think a timeline fits very well, but the way I like to think about it is, has there been change over time? So I have no parameters around how much change or what the end point of that change is. But the question of, does it feel the same today as it did last month or 6 months ago or right after she died? And if the answer is no, it doesn't feel the same now. I've learned X, Y, and Z. I have new tools in my toolkit to cope with waves of grief. I have discovered other people, maybe strengthened my relationships with people I already knew, or created new relationships with people who are there for me. Then if those things are true, there's not an end point, but there is change over time. That's what learning means, doesn't it? Change over time, even though there's no destination per se. So I think for people, if they feel like, yeah, boy, I am handling this differently than I used to. And also, I have both good feelings and bad feelings in my life, right? So I do feel waves of grief. It doesn't matter how long it's been. You're going to have waves of grief. That's just a normal human emotion. But I also have waves of awe and joy and creativity. And as long as you're getting the full range of emotions, as long as you feel like, you know, there are things that I do that feel really meaningful in my life, not necessarily even happy or good, but meaningful. And I think that's the sign of mental health to me.
And something I've heard you say before is that being able to move in and out of grief and oscillate between grief and, you know, awe and joy, and, you know, it's that dual process model, isn't it? That to you is good mental health. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah. The author Julia Samuels from the UK gives me this wonderful metaphor of being able to jump into the puddle, but also being able to jump out of it again. I just think that's such a great way to describe it, because for most of us, grief does come in waves. That is the nature of human grief, that it takes you over. And in that moment, everything feels unbearable and impossible. And then the wave sort of crests and recedes, just like the ocean. And you feel more balanced again. You feel like, okay, I can, you know, get dinner on the table or make it through this meeting or whatever it is you need to do. And so I think the ability to recognize a wave of grief. And I think to some degree, the learning that happens is also around, how do I manage those waves of grief? And that's going to look different at different moments. So if you are about to walk into a meeting and you suddenly find that you're welling up, then the way that you might handle it at that moment, which might very well be like, okay, you know what? I am just going to put this out of my head and pretend this hasn't happened. And I'm just going to focus on whatever's going to happen in this meeting. That's a different way of coping than it's evening and you're sitting and thinking of the person and feeling very wistful and sad. That's a different set of coping strategies to deal with that wave of grief. That might mean I need comfort, right? I need to reach out to someone who understands. This is often when I text my sister, right? Or it might mean, you know what? This is not helping me right now. I need to get out of the house and go for a walk, right? I need to shake this puddle off. So there are many ways that we can handle a wave of grief. And the key is to have many different options when you feel that. So I would say that it is a sign of mental health to allow the waves to come and allow them to recede again. Mm-hmm. And for some people, it is helpful. Probably not for everyone, but it can be helpful to keep, before you go to bed at night, make a note. If you're worried about how well your grieving is going, just making a note at night. What was the most grief that I felt today on a scale of 1 to 10? What was the least grief that I was feeling today on a scale of 1 to 10? And maybe what was the average? And then to be able to see over time, I mean, if we track anything, then we see patterns, don't we? And so to recognize, oh, gosh, I thought that I was feeling grief all the time, but actually there's a lot of variation in how I feel, can be very reassuring for a person.
Like a griefometer.
Yes, exactly.
A bit of grief tracking.
It's the griefometer.
We call them grief bombs, don't we, Im? And it's a term that we've coined in our community because waves to us feel way too gentle, like a bomb is, you know, just
unless it's a tsunami.
Yeah,
tsunami. Well done. Fair, we're there.
Yeah.
What's really interesting about, I guess, like tracking your grief. We've had the amazing opportunity to be able to see where we were. So we started this podcast. I was 6 months into my mum's suicide loss, which I look back now, I'm like, who the hell starts a podcast when you're like deep in like the most traumatic grief? But we all deal with it very differently. And Sal was 8 months, weren't you?
Eight or nine months.
So we have consistently done this podcast nonstop. Wow. We're committed. And we're now heading into, Sal's just gone into the fourth year and I'm not far behind. So we've been able to see how our grief evolves through our conversations.
Yes.
And sometimes we do episodes, you know, reflecting back onto those earlier episodes to our voices were different.
Yes.
I lost my humor for a long time, like in the early days. It's been so interesting to see the evolution of our grief as this podcast has gone on. But I love that, you know, if people don't have a podcast, they can just track in their notes on their phone each day and see what's changing for them. I love that.
And people do it different ways. I mean, that's a very quantitative, you know, it won't surprise anyone that that recommendation is coming from a data scientist, right? I think you could take a photograph every day of something that you notice and then be able to look back across the photographs and see how it's changed. I love the idea that your voice has changed. I mean, we forget how physical grief is. And in fact, it can affect, you know, your vocal cords, your the timbre of your voice. And that just makes sense. That's going to change. And it's also likely to re-regulate, so to speak.
And there's something that we felt happened to us, and a lot of our community have said that they experienced this too. We call it grief face. Because Ian and I both felt like I felt like the shape of my face changed for a while. Like I looked different. I did not look like myself. Yeah. Im, you felt the same. So many people have said the exact same thing.
Interesting.
But there's not a lot of research out there.
Can you describe it? I'm very curious now.
Yeah. So this is my, like, you can see my face is fairly oval shaped, but after Mum died, it felt like it was round, like it was almost swollen. Mm. I look back at the early press shots that Im and I did for the podcast when we first started, and I feel like I look different. Yeah. And Im, you felt like your face had changed as well, didn't you? You just don't feel like yourself when you look in the mirror. And obviously there's an element of like the emotional stress, the tiredness, you know, there are those elements, but there's just something in the actual, the way that we look is different.
For me, it was my eyes. Mm. Like I look back now and I don't recognize my eyes. They lost their sparkle. And my skin was dull. And I look like I'd aged about 10 years.
Yeah. And you went grey, didn't you?
And I went grey. Yeah, I've gone so grey since my mum died as well, probably. So
interesting.
Yeah, well, tell us, you know, what's going on.
Well, I mean, obviously I'm not a medical doctor, but I can tell you that our hormone levels do shift during grief. We know that. We know cortisol increases, inflammation usually increases, heart rate and blood pressure usually increase. Well, of course, all of those are going to be visible in skin and the way tissue is you know, puffy or not puffy. And I think what's notable is it's also normal, right? It's that your body has to figure out how to be in the world without this person. And although it was very invisible before, the way your physiology regulated included that person, and now they aren't there. And so your body has to figure out, oh, wait a minute, how do I do all of this being in the world without them? And your body will re-regulate. I mean, the human body and the human brain are just remarkable, right? Mm-hmm. But it's going to take some time. But that's what human beings do, right? For example, having an immune system doesn't mean you never get sick. It means that you get sick and you fight it and you feel better. That's the elasticity of the human experience. And so I just don't want people to think either that it's permanent or that there's something wrong with them. Now, having said that, if you are having difficulties, we know that, for example, heart attacks do go up during bereavement. So if you are having physical issues that are impacting your functioning, you should absolutely have those checked out and you should absolutely go to the doctor. So for example, if your blood pressure goes up and you actually are hypertensive, you can take medication for hypertension. It's not like because it was, you know, because it started during grieving that you wouldn't treat it like hypertension.
Yeah, you still got to pay attention to these things, right?
Sal, let's take a moment to talk about this season's sponsor, Picaluna Beautiful Funerals. So like us, most of you listening have probably either planned or attended your loved one's funeral. Sal, did you have any idea about what your mum wanted her funeral to be like?
I literally had a tiny idea that she wanted bright colours and that was it. What about you, Im?
Well, we never actually got to have the conversation about how she wanted her funeral, but I do remember her telling me once, this is quite funny, that she wanted to attend her own funeral so that she could hear all of the nice things that everyone had to say about her.
Oh, I love that. Classic, that's quite a good idea.
Classic Vanessa. How good, should we just have our funeral and like say all the nice things? But this is one of the main reasons, I don't think I've told you this either, but why I got up and did her eulogy, even though it was so difficult to do, because I knew from that conversation, if she was going to be anywhere that day, she would have been right there listening to what nice things that we had to say about her. But other than that, you know, I think I was just so out of it. I couldn't help with the planning at all. My sister had to pick up all of the pieces and take care of all of the planning. She is an instrumental griever. And I couldn't do it. But I do wish that I had chatted with my mum about the finer details. But how the hell do you even start those conversations?
Well, I think it's as simple as starting with like asking a question like, what piece of music is significant to you? Or what hobbies or passion do you feel reflect your personality best?
Yeah, I love those suggestions. Like they're good. And I think the thing is, being prepared for a death in your circle can sometimes feel like a daunting task, but it's something that touches us all. So I think these conversations regarding death can be difficult, but they're important to have.
They really are, and it is all about the personal touches. And that's why what Piccoluna is doing is so important, because not only do they provide end-of-life consultancy and doula support, they also help you facilitate these difficult conversations, and they make them so much easier. You know, they do the whole shebang. Their funeral arranger meets you and helps guide you in creating meaningful funerals and within your budget as well, which I think is really important. And they help you personalize it your way, so that you can really honor your person in a way that reflects them. And that could be something like, you know, a paddle out with surfers to scatter the ashes, or a gathering in bushland, by the ocean, in an event centre. Whatever you want to do, they can help you make it happen.
I wish I had known there were so many choices available. I 100% would have had Mum's funeral out in the Red Desert. She loved the outback. But something else that I love that Piccoluna are doing is they give back and they donate 5% of their profit to one of their Piccoluna charity partners, which I think is really beautiful.
Yeah, that is so beautiful. And I really love that they're giving back in that way. So guys, whether you're caring for someone at end of life, or like us, you know how bloody hard planning a funeral is when you're deep in grief, start having the conversation today with Piccoluna Beautiful Funerals. Now, back to the show. Just back to the waves of grief, aka grief bombs. What is happening on a neurological level when we all of a sudden, you know, we're going about our day and then boom, we just feel this intense grief? What's happening in our brain?
Well, it's interesting, you know, it's very likely that things get cued from the inside or from the outside, and we don't always know, right? Very often this is operating below the level of conscious awareness, right? So you're sitting at a stoplight and all of a sudden you're, you know, in tears or you're screaming and you think, wait, I was just at a stoplight. But yeah, there are a number of cues outside and a number of cues inside that can start you down the road of thinking about the loss, thinking about the person. And so regardless of what the cue is, we know that there are specific parts of the brain that are very active during a wave of grief, parts of the brain related to memory, parts of the brain related to social pain, so very close to the physical pain centers in the brain, aspects of yearning, of wanting, right, that motivation to seek out that person. And then also parts of the brain that are related to emotion regulation, right, to being able to talk yourself down, so to speak. Those parts of the brain are involved as well. And so it is a very... it's a very multidimensional experience, as all of you know. And so there are many brain areas that are involved. But we do see that people who are having more difficulty adapting, that there's sort of a network of the brain that has to do with what scientists call salience, right? Like, I'm having this grief bomb and it's so important. I can't let it go. I can't, distract myself, or I can't. And so that sort of network of brain areas being connected to each other in that moment, it's early days of neuroscience, but it does look like people who are having more difficulty grieving are showing differences in the way their brain is responding during a grief bomb.
That's fascinating, because I definitely felt like I could get stuck in it sometimes, like back in the early months. I'd say in that first year, I'd really get stuck in. I had a lot of rumination,
yeah,
which took me a long, long time to work through. And the only way that I did actually manage to work through it was understanding the mind-body connection and doing body-centered work. Oh, yeah. And that actually helped my brain,
yes,
which was just phenomenal because we don't get taught this stuff, do we? No,
we don't. We don't. But that's exactly right. I mean, we forget that the body is connected to the brain as well, as it turns out, despite what the neurology department might think, separate from the psychiatry department,
Don't want you to get in trouble here.
Well, just in the sense of, right, we divide them up in science for good reasons, but it doesn't mean they're not actually connected to each other in our body and our brain. In any case, what it means is sometimes when we can shift how our body is, that can help us to shift our mental state as well. And so this is part of that learning. What are the tools that you have at your disposal, right? That might be deep breathing. That might be going for a walk. That might be getting a hug, right? That physical experience of having a hug changes our hormones. And when your hormones change, that changes your brain. It changes the way the neurons are able to connect with each other. So I won't say that it's an exact science. I can't say, take two hugs and call me in the morning, but I can say that we know they're connected. And so what's important is to stay tuned in to how is my body and my mental state connected.
Yes. I think another thing that's been really helpful for both of us in terms of our healing is when we are in those spaces, when the grief bombs hit and we're in the car and we're crying, accepting where we're at in that moment as well, and not trying to judge it or push it aside or suppress it.
Yeah.
And since we started actually allowing ourselves to move through those emotions, the really uncomfortable ones, we started to notice a shift as well, didn't we, Sal?
We did. And I think another thing that Im and I really experienced heavily, especially in the first, I would say, year to a year and a half after our mums died, and it's something that we hear from our community often that they experience too, is brain fog and like cognitive fatigue.
Yeah.
What's happening there?
Yeah.
Tell us.
What is going on?
This is far too commonly reported for it to not be anything. I will say that This is an interesting thing to study. So we do have some, proper neuropsychological testing of people who are bereaved. And we do see sometimes some overall cognitive slowing, for example. But that's a very specific way to think about the way the mind and the brain works, right? These are, you go into a room, you try and do a test, a memory test or a fast-paced test, and we look at your mental functioning. That's not really how most of us are operating in the world, right? We're not, doing this one task alone and trying to, do our best job at it. So although there can be changes even at that level, I think the far more common thing that is happening is when you are learning, it takes a lot of mental effort. And a lot of the things that you're learning are at the level of habit or automatic processing, right? And so I think that a lot of what is happening is we're more distracted than unable to think, right? So I think both can be true, but that is to say, for example, if you're, in the grocery store and you're actually spending half of your brain thinking, oh my gosh, my daughter's birthday is coming up and her gran isn't going to send her anything. And I wonder if I should get something or would that be too weird? If that's what you're doing when you're grocery shopping, if you arrive home and you did not purchase the milk, are we surprised? Perhaps not,
Pennies just dropped. This is so interesting. It makes total sense because you do live in that world. Your brain is just constantly trying to come to terms with the reality.
So is this the map updating, right?
Yes. Google Maps firing.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and you think about, even think of the experience, right, of, I don't know if you've ever used Google Maps, but you're driving along and you're using Google Maps and then it says turn left and it's like a bike path. And suddenly you're like in panic, right? Like, wait, what's happening? How do I, you know, and you're trying to react and you're trying to, but think of all the extra processing that's happening when this thing you've depended on, this map you've been depending on to just blithely ramble through the world is wrong. And now you have to figure out how to get through the world instead. It's a lot to do.
Is there anything that helps if you are struggling with brain fog or you're struggling to concentrate? Like, is there anything that could help you, especially if you've got to, you know, work or, you know, get back into studying or something where you have to concentrate?
You know, I would say a couple of things in a funny sort of way. Some of the things we tell people who have mild cognitive impairment are relevant here. So use as many external tools as you can. Make lists, put things on your calendar, you know, turn off the irrigation can go on the calendar now, right? Like it should be just something you remember, but now just put it on the calendar. And, you know, particularly for the people who are around you, saying to them, you know, text me when you get there, remind me where you've gone, you know, like the sort of just help them to understand I'm not firing on all cylinders here. I may ask you to repeat things and just bear with me. This is part of the process. So I think relying on those external things, keeping your calendar, setting your alarm, you know, using your medication daily dosing little machine thing. So relying on all of those things helps. I think being aware of where your mind is can be helpful. And so if you're driving along, I've certainly had this experience, you're driving along and suddenly you realize, wow, I am miles away, right? I am thinking about this really painful memory, or I'm thinking about this really painful upcoming interaction I'm going to have. Pull over, right? Like recognize, oh, my mind is doing a lot right now. I cannot also ask it to drive, and it is unsafe, right, to drive if you're not able to pay attention. So you may pull over for like a minute, or you may pull over long enough to have a bit of a cry and blow your nose and then get back on the road. I think you're going to be clearer when you get back on the road, and you're not trying to do both things at once. So I think giving yourself the space and the grace to take a moment when your mind is somewhere else, rather than trying to force it to do something it's not equipped to do at that moment, can also be very helpful.
I remember getting into the car for the first time after my mom died, and it was almost like I had to learn how to drive again.
Yeah.
I couldn't work it out. I couldn't I just didn't know what was happening. It just really changes so much, doesn't it? Just while we're on to what tools can help, if we're struggling with being, I guess, like in my instance where I was just ruminating, I was just completely off on another planet. Are there any tools that can help bring us back into the present moment?
Yeah. I think of, you know, again, different tools will work for different people, but I'll give you a couple that might be helpful. One is, it started as a something we would do for people who have a lot of worry, which is a different kind of rumination, right? And we call it worry time. And the idea is you pick a time in your day, 2 o'clock today, I'm going to worry about the things I need to worry about. And then if it's 10 a.m., you say to yourself, okay, self, this is important and I will get to it at 2 p.m. So you can think of it as grief time, right? You can think, you know, I'm going to put on sad music and I'm going to, you know, do my thing at 2 o'clock this afternoon, whatever it is. You don't have to put sad music on. But the idea is you do have some influence over where your mind is. And so if at 10 a.m. you're able to say, it's not that I'm avoiding this, it's that I need to put it off a bit later. I will focus on it then because I need to do something else right now, then that can be very helpful for people. And even if it comes back to you at 10:05 and 10:10, you can just say to yourself again, yep, I hear you, still there, 2 o'clock, we have a date. I'll be with you. The other one that I think can be helpful for people, other than the thing that you mentioned about connecting with your body, so connecting with the present moment by physically doing something, whether that can be taking a deep breath and blowing it out, right? Something that really just brings you into the moment. Or it can be really becoming aware of your surroundings. what color are the walls in this room, you know, and what does it smell like in here? Those sorts of grounding things, the senses can help bring you back into the present moment because they can only exist in the present moment. And so that could be very helpful. You could put a mint in your mouth and think about how it feels and tastes, and that can bring you back as well.
So helpful. And I think Sal and I were subconsciously scheduling in that time, not worry time, but grief time. So we have what's called a grief sesh, mm-hmm. where we do put the sad music on because mm-hmm. we became so busy. We're like, we need to actually schedule in time yes. to grieve. So we would now, it's a running joke with our Good Morning community that we all go and have a grief sesh, but it works. Yes, it's amazing. It and then it helps stopping it catching you off guard when you're in the supermarket because yes. you've already, right. you know, gone and done it.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's approved by Mary Frances, so we are on the right track here. That's we right. say.
We've got the tick of approval.
The grief sesh, you know.
That's right.
Tick of approval.
I am pro grief sesh. Yes.
so interesting. I think that a lot of our listeners are going to have quite a few light bulb or, as Im said, penny drop moments here. Mm. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yes.
Where can listeners find you and your wonderful book, The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss?
Well, I am, I have, my lab has a website at MaryFrancesO'Connor.org, and you can also find the book through there. And then I'm on various types of social media as well, Instagram and Twitter and such and so forth.
Amazing.
This has been one of my favorite conversations. I know I say that a lot, but it really has. I've had many penny drop moments, which is amazing after, you know, nearly 4 years of having conversations about what's going on in our bodies and minds. There's some amazing analogies there you shared with us. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And thank you for bringing this to a community, creating a community.
Thank you.